Good afternoon. Welcome to Line One, your health connection on KSK Anchorage. I am your host, Prentice Pemberton. The leading cause of death for people 12 to 19 years old is accidental death, followed by homicide and suicide. Teens' brains are hardwired to take risks and to act impulsively, and much of this risk behavior is developmentally appropriate. The question that keeps parents up at night are what to do when that behavior gets scary. How do we help our children navigate adolescence when they won't even look at us? At what point do you seek out counseling or have the big sit down with your teen? At what point, if any, should you consider residential treatment? No matter who you are, it's likely your family or someone close to you will face the challenges of high-risk behavior in their son or daughter. How we as parents respond to those challenges will go a long way towards your teen's ability to learn from their behavior. Today's show is the third in a four-part series that focuses on parenting the modern teen. On today's show, we're going to explore the challenges of addressing high-risk behavior in teens. Joining me as returning guests for this series are three very well-respected adolescent and family therapists who have graciously donated their time and experience to Line One. Robert Rhodes is a licensed clinical social worker in private practice at Counseling Solutions of Alaska. His primary work for the last 20 years has been with challenging teens and their families. Whitney Whitman is a licensed professional counselor. She has been working with adolescents and their families in Anchorage for the past decade in residential settings, crisis intervention, and now in private practice. And Dr. Ebony McLean Owens has her PhD in psychology and is a licensed professional counselor. She has a long history of working with teens and families in a variety of settings. She is currently in practice at Bridges Counseling Connection. I want to remind listeners of Line One that Dr. Woodard will continue to bring you the latest information on a variety of health topics 3 weeks a month, and I will continue to bring you a monthly show focused on emotional health and wellness. Last bit of business, if you have any questions for today's guests or want to share some information or tips on today's topic, you can reach us in several ways. The local phone number is 550-8433, or you can call toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And you can also reach us by emailing your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. You got to spell that out, L-I-N-E-O-N-E. I'd like to thank you all for taking the time to join me again for part three of our series. I appreciate you guys being here.
Thanks for having us.
So after some technical delay of 5 minutes, we couldn't get the headphones to work, but that seems to be sorted out. I hope it doesn't go out in the middle. But on the first show, we focused on parental power and how parents address challenging behavior and the defiance that's so often associated with adolescent years. In our second show, we kind of tackled the smartphone era and the challenges that go along with our children's connectivity. Today, we're going after the heavy hitters, the behaviors that put our children at the most acute risk for harm. Drug and alcohol use, severe conduct problems, and sexual behavior will be the focus of today's show. So, high-risk behavior, I guess it depends a lot on your definition of risk, because so much of this is developmental, this risk-taking, as I mentioned in the intro. So I guess we'll start with Whitney. Can you give us a little bit of a definition of high-risk behavior for the purposes of this show today, or HRB, right? Is that what they call it?
Yes. You're spot on there with the idea that some risk-taking is very developmentally appropriate. I think when we look at high-risk behaviors, these are beyond the norm. And so what they're actually doing is disrupting your normal developmental growth. They are also behaviors that could prevent teenagers or children from engaging in important developmental tasks. So, for instance, if you're using substances to the point where you're not going to school, then you are disrupting your academic growth. And so that would be a high-risk behavior. It also has the ability to prevent future successes or future developmental growth. So anything that has kind of a long-term potential effect to make you irregular or to prevent you from meeting the normal tasks that you would even in the future, even as a young adult or a full-blown adult.
So what we're talking about is behavior that is developmentally appropriate, but sometimes it goes kind of haywire or it gets too extreme.
Yeah, I mean, I would say it's developmentally appropriate to take risks, but there's such a thing as a healthy risk and an unhealthy risk. And an unhealthy risk would put you into a category for being at a high risk to actually disrupt your growth and your safety. And, there are some things that, have consequences that are long-term or forever. And, you know, I mean, we could look at, again, I mean, drugs are an easy one to use as an example, but if you use drugs to the point where you disrupt your brain development, there's not, you can't really necessarily get that back.
All right. I guess let's start off with Robert. We're going to tackle sort of these things in order, and we're going to talk a little bit about each of them. And I mean, I guess they're going to flow back and forth because sure. they're all so intertwined. But let's start with severe oppositionality. That word is fancy for really disruptive and harmful self-destructive behavior, defiance of a parental authority, school authority, stuff like that. So, Robert, let's start with you. And
well, I think you're talking about a very small group of kids that reach that level. And these are kids that haven't responded to any conventional parenting method or school disciplinary method, for that matter. Consequences don't work. Praise doesn't work. Positive reinforcement doesn't work. Reward systems, none of that has worked. And so then they're at this stage where they're pretty much failing across the board. And these kids are out of control, completely out of control, but by definition, therefore, they're in control because they're running the school classroom, they're running the family, they're pretty much running everything. So out of control, but in control, that's interesting. I wanted to get straight to the point. So if I was a parent in this situation, the first thing I would do is find a therapist. I don't regularly recommend that, you know, for the typical adolescent problems that kids go into therapy, but this is one that's going to be a long haul, and I think they need to partner up with someone who's well-versed in adolescent therapy and worked with this population, enjoys working with this population. Then I would look at two courses of action simultaneously. One is, I call it containment. The kid is out of control, and we talked earlier in an earlier meeting about regaining parental power and things like that. And so we're talking about containment and regaining parental power. Simultaneously, I think we're talking about an assessment. What is actually driving this small group of kids to be so far out of control? So in terms of the containment piece, I just listed several points that I think need to be looked at. One would be pick your battles. And there's a couple of good books out there that I would advise parents to read. One would be by Ross Green, The Explosive Child, and the other one by Turecki, The Difficult Child. Those are two helpful books. But we're talking about picking your battles and what's important to the parents. And that's really up to the parents. It's not up to the therapist or whoever else you're talking to. And I wouldn't pick to fight battles over small things like, you know, cleaning your room and something like that. But also I wouldn't pick battles with the larger things that have natural consequences. And most parents and I disagree about this one, but I wouldn't fight battles over grades, for example. And often that's where the battleground really plays out, school performance and things like that. There's just a host of natural consequences that come with poor school performance. And I think we let those take their course and parents don't sort of pop in and fight that battle. Clear, concise, predictable structure, consequences that are enforceable. We've said that consequences don't work. That doesn't mean, however, that we wouldn't advise you to give consequences to the kids after every behavior, and they should be swift and fast and enforceable. That's very difficult to find enforceable consequences. But you certainly wouldn't ground a kid if you're going to be at work all day and they're home alone. That's something that's not enforceable. Taking something from them, pulling the car keys, things like that, those are enforceable. That's one point. I wouldn't take things personally.
Right.
I know. That's hard. It's almost impossible not to. It's almost impossible not to take it personally. But once it becomes personal, then the kids feed off that, and they cease to sort of look at, I think, at their behavior and what resulted from their behavior in terms of personal responsibility and accepting the consequences. I wouldn't reason with the kids. I think usually they're very black and white, and as soon as you start reasoning with them, then you're all locked up into power struggles and things like that. And if reason worked with these kids, then we wouldn't be having this conversation. I'd be very patient and alter my expectations. These are kids that are probably not going to graduate with their class, or there's a strong possibility of that. It's possible that they won't be raised by you. Well, the whole time until they're 18. They might end up someplace else. It's possible they'll switch schools. There's a lot of possibilities there. But I think you're in for the long haul, gradually taking back power while at the same time doing this assessment, which I'll get to in just a second. Eventually, or often, the gas tank runs empty with the parents, and I completely understand that. And then we're talking about bigger interventions like residential treatment, hospitalization, things like that that parents would rely on. Sometimes I sort of advise parents, you know, search the kid's room, and if you find some small something that's illegal, report it, and let's get them involved in the juvenile justice system. That's kind of controversial, but the juvenile justice system has leverage, and they can contain the kid. Calling the police, of course. I like the Alaska Military Youth Academy for certain kids.
Especially these typical types of kids. I want to get back to this and your other points, but we do have a call that I don't want to make Nicole wait much longer. So, Nicole, you're on the air. What can we do for you?
I'm a pilot, and I fly out into the bush a lot. And the teams out there, you see them in a lot of very desperate situations. It breaks your heart. And they don't have the same kind of access to a lot of these programs and outlets that we do have in the larger cities here along the rail belt. But one thing I've been involved with is called the ANSEP Foundation. It's the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program. And they take middle school and high school students and pair them up with adults in the fields that they're interested in. And I helped a young man from a village, and he was in a very desperate situation, and now he's employed as a aviation mechanic working on his flight ratings. But I just wanted to get that program out there. I think it's a really good outlet if parents are able to get their kids into it, and you don't have to be native Alaskan. But also just wanted to bring some attention to the plight of these teens out in the bush as well.
That sounds like a fantastic program.
Well, what I like about that program, it seems, is that it's veering from the conventional. The child has to start school at age 6 and go for 12 years until they graduate from high school with their class.
Mm-hmm.
That's just not reasonable for a number of kids. And we're slightly off topic here, but any kind of avenue that allows these sort of square pegs in a round hole world to sort of square up and be part of a program that, you know, hands-on program that works well for them, I think is a real boost and a real intervention, I think, in terms of managing oppositional behavior in the long run.
I think that kind of feeds, I know we're going to talk a little bit about this too, about modeling desired attitudes and behaviors, and that program seems like something that would help along those lines.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's I don't have any children myself, but I try to contribute to the upcoming generation. But and I do totally understand that having to stay in school K through 12 on that traditional track might not work for all students. But the other part of what I was talking about is just these the students that don't get into this program out in the bush, the teens out in a village like Nunumiqua or these very small villages, and you see these kids in just, you know, very desperate situations. You see a lot of drug abuse, alcohol abuse, incest, rape, a lot of very terrible situations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those are really good points, Nicole, and you brought up a good show for the future is something specific to the
rural
bush communities
Alaska.
In rural Alaska, because the problems are significant there. And you're right, the resources aren't available in the same way that to kids locally here. So thanks for bringing that point up.
No problem. Thanks for the show.
Okay, have a good day. All right, so Robert, we were on high-risk behavior. I want to take just a minute for those of you who might be tuning in late. My guests today are Anchorage therapist Whitney Whitman, Robert Rhodes from Counseling Solutions of Alaska, Dr. Ebony McLean Owens from Bridges Counseling Connection. And the focus of today's show is high-risk behavior. I want to remind listeners you can reach us with your questions or comments in three ways. The local phone number is 550-8433, or you can call toll-free 1-888-353-5752. The last way to reach us is by emailing your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. So, Robert, the thing that keeps jumping in my head as I hear you talk is that at some level, our children have to let us parent them. And I've said that to parents in my office, and they're like, they don't have to, you know, that's not true. I will parent them however I want. But the kids have to participate in this. It is a sort of a parent-child contract. And what I run into with this severe oppositional behavior, and you guys can jump in on this, is that those tools aren't working anymore. Kids are walking out the door at, you know, 10 o'clock at night and coming back the next morning. Parents are calling the police. They're reporting them as runaway. And the kids are just running the show. I mean, and I have parents who are at their wits' end, and they're saying, what do I do now? And at what point do you draw the line on, or do you draw that line in the sand and refer to North Star or, as you mentioned, the academy? Where is that? Where does it become so unsafe that you can't do it?
Well, I think it's about severity, right, and consequences. And we were talking earlier about the consequences, whether they're logical, natural consequences for some of the behaviors. And I think what I see most is that a lot of times parents will enable some of these kids who have severe oppositional defiance by not allowing them to have those consequences and not trying to disrupt that cycle that's been created. And you see parents feed this because of their own fears. And so I think at some point, you know, when you talked about calling the police and sending kids to the juvenile justice system or sending them to North Star, if it becomes a safety issue, a danger to you in your own home, which often I think we do see parents are fearful of their own children, then I think it's time to step in. At that point, do you have to make a decision?
Or if you see that your children are engaging in, you know, like we were defining high risk, are engaging in sexual behaviors or abusing substances to such a level that they are going to do themselves irreparable damage. And then it is your job as a parent to find some place, because it's obviously not your home at that point, where that child can have some kind of intervention. At some point, they're either going to take to it or not. And, you know, Robert, you were painting the very difficult picture of, you know, us not being able to parent our children until they're, you know, through 18 like we expect. And, you know, as parents, we have so many hopes and dreams for our children. And, you know, certainly adolescence, even at its best, is a time where those hopes and dreams start to fall apart because our children are becoming their own people. And when our children are unfortunately becoming people who are making very, very bad decisions for themselves, it's still our job to try to protect them even from their own selves.
You know, and I think the other piece of that, what I often tell parents too is, you know, sometimes your home starts to become a residential treatment. You find yourself locking doors and locking up knives and all of these things. And I often have to give parents the hard choice of either your home becomes the residential treatment facility or you have to send your child out of your home. And that's a hard decision. Like you talk about, that's really like a grief and loss for parents, the loss of those hopes and dreams that you had for your child.
Very much so.
But you're doing it on behalf of your child.
You're doing it on behalf of your child. Right. It's, right? The best thing for your child.
And I guess, you know, you bring up that grief and loss piece, and we're talking a little bit about what parents can and can't do. And it makes me think, too, Robert, you started off by saying, okay, with these types of high-risk behaviors where your children are so oppositional that they've really just taken all boundaries and thrown them out and they're doing whatever they want, right? And you said, well, the first step is you need to find a counselor for that child. I really think it's important that the parents find their own counselor. And I can't, I mean, you know, when these types of children come into my office, I'm usually having the conversation of where are you going to get support? Because it's the parents that need the most support because they're the ones that have to struggle through this. They're the ones that are grieving. They're the ones who have to put these consequences into place that are enforceable. And it's all tiring. It's so exhausting. And there's so much emotion wrapped up into it that to me, I don't see how the success will occur if you don't have some kind of objective outside support. I mean, certainly if you're married and you have your partner, you have good friends, you have extended family you can lean upon, that absolutely is helpful and it's integral. But sometimes you need an objective person who's willing to say to you, no, you can't do this anymore, or here's something you need to start doing. There's no wiggle room anymore. And I just think that's vital. It's absolutely vital.
Yeah, parent involvement in therapy is an important piece. I'm glad you brought that up because you're right. They're at their wits' end. They're immersed so deeply in the middle of it that oftentimes parents can't see the outside and what's really going on as far as how their parenting is contributing potentially unintentionally to some of these reinforcing of these negative behaviors. And it is so hard to hold that line day after day, especially if you don't know if what you're doing is right or or being effective. And it takes a long time to turn these behaviors.
And at the end of the day, those children are still our babies. You know, we look at those children and we see our babies. We see our infants. We see our three-year-olds. We see our seven-year-olds, you know, with their gap tooth missing. And, you know, I mean, so it's sometimes hard to be objective about what you're supposed to do as a parent when you have all that history wrapped up in your relationship with your child.
I don't want to forget the assessment piece. And I know I could get real long-winded about that, but there's something fueling these kids.
Yeah.
And that has to be answered. You can't contain them if you can't simultaneously understand why they're doing what they're doing and what's fueling that behavior. And I get back to that square peg and round hole stuff in the school setting. I get back to temperament, genetics. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a long list of things that we need to understand in order to sort of help the kids and things like that. So I just don't want to jump over that piece.
You said something to me really important a long time ago, or I don't remember what it was, but it was a while ago. You said that you need to parent the kid that you have instead of parenting the kid that you want.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Which goes to what we've been talking about, this, you know, the square peg in a round hole, finding things that they will be successful at. And maybe it's not college. Maybe it's not, maybe it is Job Corps. Maybe it is the military. Mm-hmm. Maybe it is something different. But we get so caught up in our own ideas for what we want for our kids.
And your own expectations of them, that sometimes you're not able to see who they are as people.
Well, and I think we have a lot of fears. I mean, in our culture, there is a track that you're supposed to take, and that's
right.
supposed to lead to financial success, and financial success equals emotional success. And I think, you know, it's very easy to get caught up in the idea that if our children don't follow that track, that maybe they won't be successful.
Right.
And of course, what we all want is for our children to be not only financially successful, but also emotionally successful.
And if the children aren't successful, then a lot of times parents struggle with what does that say about me
right.
as a parent.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely. We all think that, yeah.
Well, and if they're not successful, they become angry.
Yeah.
And then we get caught up in the anger piece and forget, you know, why they aren't being successful and why they aren't developing competence and self-confidence and those kind of things.
Is it accurate to say that anger and aggression and irritability in teenagers is generally linked almost always to some sort of depressive kind of low-grade depression or lack of success? Academically or with peers, it seems to me that there's always some sort of link to that.
I would say it could be anxiety too. But when we say that, I want to make it clear that it's pervasive anger mm-hmm. and irritability. You
right.
know, it's not like, I mean, I think even the happiest and you know, most functional teenager could have that snapping moment where they just bite your head off for no reason.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're like that, you know, day in, day out, yes, I would say there's an underlying, I mean, anger is a secondary emotion. It's just easier for us to feel because it fuels us, it empowers us. But really underneath, we're definitely feeling other more difficult emotions like depression or anxiety.
How should people identify, Robert, you said an assessment, a therapist. How should they just open up the phone book and find a therapist? Or what's the best way to find somebody? You said that's worked with teenagers, that likes to work with teenagers, because it's a special breed.
Yes, it is.
I like that. It's a special breed. The kids, right, not the therapist. Or both.
The therapist. The therapist.
Both, yeah.
Well, I like working with that population because it's a puzzle for me.
Yeah.
Why in the world is this kid not responding to the typical consequences and societal norms, et cetera, that come across the board? But I don't know how you would find it. I mean, word of mouth, talk to your friends, consult with people at the school district, the nurses, counselors, refer people. There's a whole host of ways, but
I think you can do a web search nowadays. And I know there's a lot of good counselors that don't have much of a web presence here. But for instance, you know, if you call someone that you find on the web, you can ask them too. If you liked them, you can say to them, you know, if you're not accepting clients, who else do you know that mm-hmm. is accepting
right.
clients? I mean, I'm always happy to be a resource to the community and point them in good directions of adolescent counselors.
But I think the subject we're talking about really demands a therapist who has experience in that area and who enjoys working with those kids.
Most
and,
definitely who
and
enjoys
families.
It.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They're so challenging.
Because I get a lot of teens that have come through multiple therapists and have had really difficult experiences.
Mm-hmm.
Not because the therapist wasn't good, it's just that they were in over their heads, I think, with teenage mm-hmm. attitudes and problems. Okay, we are at the 30-minute break, so I want to remind folks you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSK Anchorage. Our local number is 550-8433. You can call toll-free at 1-888-353-5752, and our email is line1@alaskapublic.org. After this short break, we'll continue our conversation with our guests, Robert Rhodes, Whitney Whitman, and Dr. Ebony McLean Owens. I'm Prentice Pemberton.
You're listening to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line One, your health connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Line One, your health connection from KSK Anchorage. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. In case you're just joining us, I have in studio Robert Rhodes of Counseling Solutions of Alaska, Whitney Whitman, and Dr. Ebony McLean Owens of Bridges Counseling Connection. Today's show is part three of a four-part series on parenting the modern teen. Part one and two of the series, along with all of the Line One archive shows, can be podcast at our website, alaskapublic.org. Just click on the link to Line One. I want to remind folks that each show has a variety of links that elaborate and go into depth on the subjects that we talk about, so be sure to check those out. Today's topic is parenting high-risk behavior. I want to remind listeners that Dr. Woodard will continue to bring you a variety of health information on Line One, your health connection, 3 Mondays each month, and I'll continue to host a monthly show on mental health and emotional wellness. You can email questions or comments to today's show to line1@alaskapublic.org or call locally at 550-8433 or toll free at 1-888-353-5752. Please remember, if you're listening between 9 and 10 p.m. on Monday evening, you'll be hearing a taped recording and we will not be accepting phone calls. During the break, Whitney brought up a good point that we should go ahead and get to. What about the young person, the teenager, who is engaging in high-risk behavior, drugs, sex, but they're making decent grades and they're going to their skating practice and their soccer practice and, you know, they're managing to maintain the day-to-day things, but they're engaging in behavior that might really result in some serious long-term consequences. How do we address that as parents? And because, you know, they're doing everything okay on the outside, but what's going on inside that we need to address?
Well, and I think the reason why I brought that up is because the first thing that comes up is that how do parents even know? Because they trust these kids, and these kids are doing well. They are finding success in lots of areas of their life. And it's not until their kid gets pulled over for a DUI when they were supposed to be at someone's house spending the night, or until, you know, they come home and tell you that they have an STD, that you even knew that they were engaging in these high-risk behaviors. And so I guess I just wanted to talk about some of the risk factors that you can look for in your children, even when they're being successful, that might tell you that, you know, maybe you're missing something. And it's, of course, going to go back to communication, which is something we've talked about on all of these shows, and monitoring your children, even if you trust them. You know, it's still okay to call, and they're going to hate you for it, but it's still okay to call your 16-year-old's friend's parents to make sure they're spending the night there, even if they're driving themselves over there and getting up and going to work the next morning. And yeah, of course, your 16-year-old is going to think that that is the most embarrassing thing you could ever do to them, but it's probably a really wise choice. And I think looking for, you know, having conversations with your children about how they feel about themselves, what's their self-esteem like, getting to know their friends really well, having their friends over for meals, having them over for sleepovers, you know, what kind of peer group are they engaging in? What do their peers do with their time, and what are their parents like, and getting to know their peers' parents? And I know this is all really time-consuming to ask, but it's very, very important in getting your child through their adolescent years safely.
Oh, yeah.
And then I think, you know, really just really amping up the monitoring, even though that's the time when your kids really want to push you away from monitoring them. And that is normal. We talked about what's normal risk taking. That is normal. And so I look at it as kind of like a, you know, a hand holding. It's not a big hug anymore. It's a hand holding. And, you know, I'm willing to let you have this freedom as long as there's a certain level of monitoring that's occurring, and that I know where you are and I know what you're doing and I know what's taking place there. Because certainly, I mean, we're talking about like that, you know, 15, 16, 17-year-old age group with that kind of stuff mostly. And those kids are going to be out of the house really soon. They're going to have that whole world at their feet. So, you know, reminding them of that and not giving in to their pressure for you to just let the reins loose and let them go live their own lives just because they're in high school.
They're going to win their independence. The only question is, how will they feel about you once they've gained it?
How will they feel about themselves? How, I mean, I really ask, how are they going to feel about themselves? You know, they can hate me throughout their adolescence as long as when they're 18, they still like themselves. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, kids end up making decisions that by the time they get to be young adults, they don't feel any better about themselves. And then they continue to repeat those same mistakes as young adults, that same sexual acting out, that same drug and alcohol abuse. You know, we're not going to get into self-harm, but self-harm certainly incorporates me. I'm sure everyone who has a child at this point who's in adolescence has heard of cutting and self-interest behaviors and that shame that goes along with making bad decisions. And like Robert said, feeling like you're in control when really you're out of control.
Mm-hmm. I think it's important to add that, that teenagers like to be tracked. They just like to be tracked from a distance. That's the hand-holding versus the hugging. But I don't know that any teenager will look back and say, geez, my parents wanted to know my friends, and they had their finger on the pulse, you know, appropriately, and teenagers regretting that.
And I think I see on the opposite side, you know, of that when parents don't check in. I get a lot of adolescents who are saying to me, my behaviors are this way because my mom doesn't ask me how my day was. She doesn't know any of my friends. She doesn't check in with me. And, you know, I think parents underestimate how important they are to their adolescents. Right? I get parents all the time that will say to me, well, I didn't think my kid wants to talk to me. And I just had that same kid in my office crying before the parent comes back about how they wish they had a better relationship with their mom or their dad, or they wish somebody was checking in. So when we look at some of these behaviors, some of them, you know, these high-risk behaviors a lot of times are an attention-seeking cry for, you know, I need my parent to be involved.
Pay attention to me.
Pay attention to me. I'm here. I'm not invisible.
And put those limits up because I don't really know what those limits are, and my friends want me to cross over them, and it all seems really scary, but I'm going to do it anyway, so could you please tell me no?
Yeah, because if you tell me no, then I have a good excuse because my mom said it or my dad said it's not happening. You know, it's scary to be out there and be young and have all these pressures and not have somebody setting those limits and boundaries for you.
I had a kid ask me, how do I say no to smoking weed when all my friends are doing it? I say, tell them that you're pain in the rear parents are drug testing you every month.
That's right.
Totally. And he's like, whoa, good
That's
idea.
A good one. Yeah.
I do want to take just a second and we'll go to a call. We got Tim, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks a lot. I'm older and I remember, you know, kids would get to the point where they hated their parents so much there would be a fist fight, and then, you know, they weren't welcome at home anymore and they headed out onto life on their own.
Right.
I have children, you know, now, and really don't want them to be homeless or out on the streets. And it seems like one of the bigger challenges is what should they do in their free time. What's worked for me in the past, and I'd like to suggest for people who are looking for something to do with their kids or to get their kids involved in, are, you know, outdoor activities. Not so much team sports, but kind of the unstructured, casual frisbee golf, biking, even skiing, because there's so much winter here. And even if, I mean, I saw a lot of kids playing frisbee golf with beer and smoking weed, but they brought that with them.
Yeah.
And the longer they stay with it, sports like that, the more the positive benefits wear off on them, and they can use it as an opportunity to have positive success, you know, positive interaction with their peers in the environment. And it's pretty low cost, and it's very popular with 15, 16, and 17-year-olds.
I think that's a great point, and I think that your outdoor activities, you know, persuasion is a wonderful one, because I have to say that the most unhappy adolescents I have in my office and the most anxious adolescents I have in my office here in Alaska, it's because they don't do anything outside in the winter.
Right.
And, you know, and maybe they don't have the right gear, or maybe there's no one to go do it with them. But I don't know that, you know, I would say even to my adult clients that anyone should survive the winter here spending that much time inside and hunkering away from the cold, because it's not good for the mental health.
The Frisbee Golf Course at Westchester was so popular that they had to close it in the summer because there were so many people using it. But it is open in the winter, mm-hmm. and it's a fun little course to play, and recommend people try that out. Thanks.
Appreciate
Thank you
the
so
call.
Much.
It was definitely very popular when I worked residential treatment.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I think Tim brings up a really good point that boredom is the enemy mm-hmm. of success in adolescence. And the more kids get involved when they're on my caseload, and the more they say, "Well, our schedules are so busy, I don't think we have time to come see you." And I say, "That's great."
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's outstanding, because it's exactly what we want to happen. If they're coming in to see me during school because they have all Fs, mm-hmm. you know, that's a different scenario, and they're very bored, and that's tough.
And that, I think that's, you know, when we talk about these risk behaviors, that's part of a huge problem in living in Alaska. As I hear that from lots of clients, I am bored. Dealing with boredom is a skill, and we talk about ways that you cope with boredom and how you deal with it by getting involved in activities. But I think you see a lot of this unhealthy coping, you know, in the wintertime when it's dark and people get depressed. You know, and they don't do those outdoor activities. They find other things to do, like drink mm-hmm. and smoke, because they're bored.
Mm-hmm.
So
we talked a little bit about on our show regarding electronics and teens, too. I think it's an important skill to learn how to occupy your time independently and individually. I
yes.
mean, that's a lifelong skill. You know, that's it's spiritual. It feeds your soul. You know, it's not just about outdoor activities, but really it is about, you know, being creative and monitor, you know, keeping up with your time and how you spend it.
It's interesting that you say that. I was reading an article about adults dealing with boredom and mm-hmm. how we spend so much of our lives trying to figure out as adults how to cope with being bored.
Yeah.
So it is a skill that needs to start early.
Idle time. We got an email here that says, "How is counseling for high-risk behavior paid for?" Hmm. I guess that's a good question.
I think there's a lot. It depends on what kind of counseling you're talking about. I mean,
right.
outpatient counseling, unfortunately, is usually paid for by health insurance, which not all of us have. So it can be very costly if you don't have health insurance. Of course, if you're on Medicaid, there are several places around town that you can have your Medicaid billed for that. If you're talking about inpatient and hospitalization or residential treatment, it's, again, usually the default is health insurance. However, in the state of Alaska, if your child is out of your home for 30 days, you can often apply and receive Medicaid for that child. So that's how they can go to residential without you going bankrupt.
For a year or, mm-hmm. or six yeah. months. Yeah, it's quite pricey.
And there are some sliding scale counselors in town
yes.
that can be found. And, you know, I don't have a list of them in front of me, but there are people, you know, there's people who are working towards licensure that want to, you know, get the hours in and are happy to see. They can't bill insurance anyway, so they're happy to see clients at a sliding scale fee, which means based on your income, that's what they'll charge you. There are some places around town where you can get free counseling. They usually have long waiting lists, like Anchorage Community Mental Health and
mm-hmm.
Denali Family Services, places like that.
So let's switch gears real quick and get into substance abuse. We are, as normal, running short on time, and substance abuse is a significant issue that really terrifies me as a parent, and it scares most of the parents that I work with when their kid is coming home and smoking and drinking and comes in smelling, reeking of alcohol, and how much, again, of this is normal developmental stuff, and what are the current best practices and policies for parents as far as substance abuse?
Well, I think when we look at substance abuse, in terms of best practices, I think what we're going to find is that it's really more about, like, involving the entire community. So when you're looking at a lot of the dual diagnosis is what we call it, so you're treating not just the substance abuse itself, but whatever's underlying it. For most adolescents, it's going to be depression and anxiety and or anxiety. And then you're looking at family intervention. You know, the biggest mistake I think that many parents make is that they think that they're going to send this child to treatment and that this substance abuse treatment is going to fix their child, and then what happens is the child returns to the same environment that he or she left, and there are, like Robert was saying earlier, underlying reasons, right? And you're trying to get to those underlying reasons. And so when you're looking at best practice now, it's really about, having a family intervention, seeing the kid, making sure that if there's a depression or anxiety need that needs to be met, that there's medication for that, that you're also checking in with the family doctors, that you're checking in with the schools and the school counselors, that you're trying to really involve the community in the success of this child.
What about the kid who's like getting good grades, but he's like stoned every day? I mean, what do you, and he's not causing lots of behavioral problems,
right.
And the parents are saying, well, there's so much stigma attached with substance abuse, mm-hmm. and mental health too, which is probably another good show. But substance abuse treatment, no parent wants to label their kid an addict when they're 16 years old. And how do we really know that this kid is an addict when they're 16 year old versus a, you know, problem use versus a substance abuse problem?
I think that gets back a little bit to what Robert was saying earlier about sometimes you have to pick your battles and you have to allow, natural consequences to occur. And it's unfortunate because no one wants their 16-year-old smoking weed all day, regardless of whether or not they're making good grades.
Right.
However, it might not be until that 16-year-old becomes a 25-year-old and realizes that their relationships are not as connective as they could be or as emotionally intimate as they could be, until they start to realize that their memory is faltering them. It unfortunately might be, until that child makes that decision that pot is no longer serving them, even though they've been able to hold a job, make good grades, all that stuff.
So you're saying that might be a decision that they have to make as an adult?
It may be. And I mean, I guess one of the things I work with parents on is not risking their relationship with their child. Maintain a relationship with your child rather than engaging in that constant power struggle of, like Robert was saying, trying to enforce something that's not enforceable.
Mm-hmm.
I think the chronic pot smokers, I'm getting back to Ebony's point, there's something underlying that.
Absolutely.
And how do you get to that point? But mm-hmm. the kids that are smoking a lot of pot in my office are managing anxiety, they think they're managing anxiety. They think they're managing depression. It's helping them sleep, et cetera, et cetera. So there's something
Or going making in. Them better drivers. I love that one.
I mean, you can't fight that battle if you're a parent. If you choose to pick that battle, you can fight it. Drug testing and mm-hmm. substance abuse assessments and, treat it like any other kind of extreme behavior.
Just I guess that's my question then, and I get that all the time. And I get maybe there's not a concrete black and white answer. Maybe it depends on the kid because I hear that all the time. When should I get an assessment at VOA? Should I look at residential treatment options for substance abuse or should... They're doing okay. Should we just try to get them through to college and adulthood and, and see what happens?
I always ask the question, how disruptive is it to your child's life? Like, what's the consequences been already? What kind of things are occurring? What do you fear will happen? Right? Because I think a lot of times we're looking at, how disruptive is it if you've got a child? And, I know that people are going to disagree on this, but if you have a child who's getting A's and who's not causing a problem, right? How severe does that child need to go to residential? Are they really going to qualify? Probably not, right? And that's the thing, you have to figure out how to pick and choose your battles wisely.
That's a tough one to just sit back and I guess you could.
I don't think you have to sit back. I mean, no. You made a good point.
Never
you can still
it.
You can still drug right. test them. You can still go through the motions. I mean, we were talking earlier about, going through the room and finding something illegal. I mean, you have options, but right. you only have so many options. I mean, if the child's really, we're talking about oppositionality. So this is, this is the child who's either depressed or anxious, self-medicating, maybe doing okay in school, maybe doing okay right. peer-wise, maybe even has some activities going on. It doesn't mean that you stop doing the things that you're going to do, but at some point the power struggle becomes just that, a power struggle.
And I think what I tend to work most with is when we talked about this in a previous show about negotiating the rules, setting the limits and boundaries so that there is this hard line in the sand. The problem is that when there is a consequence that needs to be enforced, will the parents enforce it? And, I think that you talk about like drug testing. I have, have had clients in the past who have agreed to be randomly drug tested. And if a parent says that I'm going to randomly drug test you and that's part of the rules for this house, then you need to enforce that. And I think a lot of what happens is that it doesn't get enforced. And then these problems occur.
Well, I have parents who feel like they can't control their children's substance abuse, but they certainly then aren't going to give them keys to a car.
Exactly.
You don't get to drive anymore.
That's right.
Because that's like, you know, a speeding death machine then.
Exactly. And I spend so much time with adolescents saying, you know, these are the consequences, and reminding them that when I do have parents that enforce them, that this is not about your parent being a bad parent or being angry. This is about the choice that you've made.
Mm-hmm.
And now you need to live with the consequences of your choice. And so, you know, Whitney talked earlier about at some point, you know, kids turn into adults and they may look back and they might have to make those choices as adults and, you know, accept the consequences that come along with them.
What do we do with kids who have our kids' friends whose parents let them use and let them, and what can we say? Because that's, in my opinion, not acceptable to allow kids to party and to hang out at your house and do that thing. But how do you police that when your kids are wanting to go to the cool parents' house? Robert, you got any ideas on how to police that?
I know exactly how to handle that.
Oh, good.
I don't think we want to blow substance abuse out of proportion and make it a different category than all these other sort of aberrant behaviors. It's a behavior that's not healthy, and we parent it accordingly. And so, you know, what would you do if your son or daughter were over at somebody's house and they were dividing up the spoils from, you know, going through people's cars the night before? You know, you would act on that instantly. So I think drugs and alcohol are no different. And I think that the teenagers coming to my office anyway, they can differentiate between sort of moderate use, recreational use, so I get high when I'm with my friends on Friday and Saturday, and daily chronic use, and they know something fundamentally is wrong. I think they do, and they don't need their parents to tell them that, especially when they very quickly come clean and tell you that they're struggling with anxiety and things like that. And so I would fight that battle. You know, you got to draw the line in the sand. Mm-hmm. You can't visit that family.
Right.
Right? Call the other parents. Of course, the other parents are contributing to it, it sounds like.
But then they know that you know.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And they may be less inclined to do that.
Right.
Because they know there's consequences legally.
And I think part of, you know, when I hear even that scenario, part of what I find, too, is that some parents are so fearful about substance abuse and what their children will do outside of the house that they think that they're, you know, by having them do it in the house, that they're actually policing it.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I can't tell you the number of times I've heard that argument.
Mm-hmm.
I'd rather them do it here with me than out on the streets where I don't know what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
High-risk sexual behavior, Whitney. What is the definition of that? Because again, developmentally, sexual exploration, trying things out, when does it become something that parents should intervene with, and how do you have that conversation?
Well, I think there's a lot of different answers to that question. I mean, the most basic would be having unprotected sex. I think that can go all the way up to putting, you know, yourself in a position where there are drugs and alcohol involved and you aren't capable of protecting yourself or making clear choices for yourself around your sexuality. And then there's, you know, the gray area in between those two things of even multiple partners, of, you know, allowing yourself to be talked into doing things that you're not comfortable doing yet. And that, you know, usually comes back to self-esteem. That usually comes back to a secure sense of self and your peer group and those types of pressures. You know, I think that the most important thing with sexuality is that parents are willing to talk about it, which is a really difficult thing to do. And of course, your adolescent's going to squirm and moan and not want to talk about those things. But I think it's important to normalize sexuality. You know, I mean, that's how your kids got here. So being able to talk about, you know, your own experiences from, you know, a place of not necessarily disclosing everything that you went through or, you know, but rather just being able to say it's okay. This is not like a taboo subject. And I think that that differs from parent to parent, depending upon what your own personal beliefs are around sexuality. So I can't sit here and say this is exactly how you have to go about doing this, because different parents have different fundamental beliefs about that. But as far as the definition of it, I think it's really vast, and it really is personal.
I used to love it when my parents talked about sex. They're both psychologists and grew up in that joy of sex era, so it was...
And I guess I would like to, before I forget, I want to say that Planned Parenthood has a really wonderful program where you can, you know, take a whole group of teenagers there and they will just do a sex ed class for them. And I don't know the specifics around that, but I've had them come to, like, girls groups that I've run. Mm. And I think it's much different than the health class sex ed that they're going to get at school.
Right.
It's way more realistic, and it's much more detailed, and they do also talk about sexual health. So it's not just like, here's all these horrible things that could happen. And it's also about, like, how do you know that you're making healthy decisions about your body? And I have to say that the nurses over there just do a phenomenal job, and they're funny and they're fun and it's anonymous, and really your kids can get in a carload of kids together and go there and do that with them.
All right. Well, we are out of time. I guess I would like to thank today's guests, Robert Rhodes from Counseling Solutions of Alaska, Dr. Ebony McLean Owens from Bridges Counseling Connection, and therapist Whitney Whitman. We will all be back here together in 4 weeks for the last of our four-part series on parenting the modern teen. Next time, we will be discussing the challenges of blended families, divorce, and single parenting. We hope that you'll be able to join us for that. If you would like to continue today's conversation, join KSKA on Facebook. You can find the link on our website, alaskapublic.org, and you can let us know your thoughts about today's show at our email address at line1@alaskapublic.org. Quick public service announcement. In doing all of this research, I found that texting and driving is perhaps the single most serious threat to your teen's safety. Half of all deaths by teens are accidental. Of those accidental deaths, the majority are teen drivers and passengers. Look into apps like Drive Off, Drive Mode, Drive Scribe, and Canary. These disable texting and track phone use while driving. So that's an interesting resource for parents to look at. Dr. Woodard will return next week and will take you back in time to the town of Anchorage in 1915. Joining him are historian Dr. Steve Haycox and physician Dr. Jay Butler. They will be exploring the living conditions and health issues from the days when Anchorage was a mere tent city with 2,000 inhabitants. So why not tune into your health and learn more Monday, February 3rd at 2 o'clock, repeating that same evening at 9 p.m. on 91.1 KSKA Anchorage. Pat Yak is the Chief Content Officer for Public Media. Kristen Platt is our web editor and audio engineer for today's show. Remember, the most important tool in the box is you as a parent. I'm Prentice Pemberton. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.